You probably expect me to say, well, I'm happy to be here. I am happy to be here. I really, really mean it. And there are a lot of reasons. I have had the honor, and I mean that, of being with this congregation in days gone by. And every time I have come, I have found this church to be friendly and kind and gracious and encouraging. And so I'm happy, happy to be here. The last time I was here, Dan took me over to Fort Lauderdale to catch a flight back to Nashville. And by the time I got my clothes back on after getting through security, you know, it takes you a while to do that, and hoping, you know, when they don't let your belt go through that your trousers will stay up and all that. I just barely got on the flight. One seat left back near the back on the aisle. I usually like a window. I think the pilots need all the help I can give them, but on the aisle. And after a tremendous breakfast of a cup of coffee and a half of a sweet roll, we're flying toward Nashville. And a gentleman across the aisle looked over at me and said, "You got a dime?" And I thought, what in the world does he need with a dime? But good Samaritan that I am, I'm digging in my pocket trying to find him one. Well, I didn't have one in that pocket, so I go to my other pocket. And I'm digging for that dime, wondering, man, they'd give him coffee, and he can't buy a paper on this plane. And a fine lady sitting by me, looked like in a business suit, said to me, "I don't know if he wants Eastern time or Central time." And then it hit me. And they didn't laugh for a minute, and I got tickled at myself. And then we all had a tremendous laugh all the way to Nashville. If I looked at that man and his wife, they'd start laughing. Well, we got to Nashville, and I discovered they're going on to Phoenix. So I'm up getting my little attaché case down, and somebody punched me in the side, and I looked around. And there's that nice lady. She said, "Here's a dime you may want to give that man." So right before I left, I said, "Oh, by the way, here's that dime you wanted." Now, they've been telling me down at Riggs, where I've been blessed to work now in my 11th year, that I need a hearing aid. I mean, one of our elders has been on my case like you wouldn't believe. So I finally went and had this doctor to check my ears. "Yeah, you need one for each ear," he said. So I bought these. You know, I'm modest. I don't have any problem with glasses, but I don't even wear contacts. But man, you know, I don't want stuff in my ear so people can see that. So I got these you stick down in the ear canal. The first one I kept nearly a whole day before I lost it. And I'm serious. Had to go buy another one, you know. So I didn't wear them on the plane. I didn't know, but the air pressure might throw them out, you know. But I'm hearing pretty well. When I think about opportunities to serve the Lord, I realize at this point of my earthly sojourn that my service for God is primarily history. God willing, in a few weeks, I'll hit the big 8-0 number. And I've read the book. You know, I read the 90th Psalm. So I surely understand. And it makes me more appreciative of getting to be with folks like you. I'm talking about the people I'm expecting to live with forever in heaven. When I come to this point of my earthly journey and get to be with these heavenly-oriented people, it just makes me grateful to God that He has given me the opportunity to use my life in serving the cause of Jesus Christ. There may be preachers that have a greater appreciation for elders than I have, but I'd sure like to meet them sometime. I have a profound appreciation for elders. Obviously, I have a great appreciation for preachers. I kind of envy Dan being able to take a break and do writing like he's doing. I appreciate Dan, what he means, not just to this church, but to the brotherhood. And David Spruill, I have a respect for this man, an appreciation. I went down to East Hill in Pulaski. I was the preacher at East Hill back in the 50s, and I go back often for special occasions. And it was right after they'd had their lecture program, and David evidently was the high point of that lecture program. I mean, they were high on him like you wouldn't believe. And I said, well, I'm not surprised. I'm happy, but it doesn't surprise me at all. And am I glad for this congregation in our brotherhood? We need congregations like this one. And I'm glad for young men like David, men that I believe know the truth and love it and appreciate it, know what the church is, love it and appreciate it. And like an old commercial says, with young men like David, the cause of Christ is in good hands. Now back to elders. I want to read one statement in 1 Peter 5 and 1, and that'll be the beginning point. The Apostle Peter said, the elders which are among you, I exhort, who am also an elder, and a witness of the sufferings of Jesus Christ, and a partaker of the glory that shall be revealed. Shepherd the flock of God. This is the New King James. Shepherd the flock of God, which is among you, taking the oversight thereof. Now, I want to key for a minute on that word, exhort. That word in the original is a beautiful, beautiful word. It's a compound word. The stem of it is the very word from which we get the word church. It's from kleo. You just put a different prefix with it to get church. You put an ek prefix, which means out of, to call out of. To get exhort, you put a different prefix, which literally means to call beside, to call to your side. Many times it's translated comfort in the New Testament. For example, in 2 Corinthians 1, 3, and 4, when Paul said, blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies and the God of all comfort, who comforts us in all of our trouble, that we may be able to comfort those who are in any trouble by the comfort wherewith we ourselves are comforted of God. Over and over, calling to your side. And in a sense, when God comforts, he says, I just want to call you to my side and to assure you that whatever the tribulation may be, whatever the heartache and the heartbreak may be, I'm standing right here with you. It's kind of like a man up where I preach. Church was going through some difficulties back a few years ago. I hadn't been there but less than a year. And that man told me, and I could take you to the place in the old building where it happened. I could take you to the very seat in the, we were in the aisle. And he said, I want to tell you something. If everybody in this church walks away from you, I'm going to be standing right by your side. And he meant it. And I reminded him of that along. And he reminds me, I meant that. I said, I know you meant it. Well, now, when God comforts, it's kind of like, okay, I'm calling you to my side. The Apostle Peter is saying here to elders, I want to call you to my side. Now, why would elders need to be exhorted, to be comforted? Well, any of you who are elders have the answer. And I have two things in mind in talking about elders today. I want to exhort the elders, and I want to encourage some of you to be thinking in terms of one day I'd like to serve God in that capacity. That is a great, great honor to serve God as an elder of His church. I've been honored to do the funerals for most of the men under whom I was blessed to serve at Creve Hall Church for 16 years. Back, not more probably than 6 months ago, did a funeral for Brother Jim Moon. Brother Moon was a great servant of God, great brother in Christ, and a great friend. He was a World War II veteran in submarine duty, and he told me that all through the war, he slept on a little cot between two torpedoes. That was his place of sleeping every night. But I mention at the funeral services for these men and other elders that I've been honored to do funerals for. This man was in the highest office in the land. And I don't just say that from talk, I mean it. See, a governor, he deals with the present. A president deals with the present, primarily. Things pertaining to this world. Elders deal with the eternal part of people. They deal with their everlasting spirits. That's why it's the greatest work in the world. It's kind of like James A. Garfield observed when he was elected president of the United States. He said, I stepped down out of the pulpit into the president's chair. And there's a lot of truth in that. Well, elders need exhortation, and if you plan to be one, we'll just give it to you up front. Because elders have to deal with a lot of problems. They really do. Some problems that are heartbreaking problems. And sometimes in dealing with problems, elders keep confidential information that they have that the church generally doesn't have. And sometimes they'll make a decision and some people get upset because they don't know the facts in the case. And so it's kind of like a man stood in my office door one day and he said, Tom, I won't come in and talk to you. He said, now, I don't have a problem. I just won't talk to you a little bit. Is that okay? I said, come on in. He said, I bet you don't hear that much, do you? I said, no, sir. Nearly everybody that comes through that door has a problem they want to talk to me about. And elders have to deal a lot with problems. It's in a way, and I've wondered about this. My oldest son practices at a walk-in clinic over in Lebanon. And I've wondered about people who have to listen all the time to where people tell them where they hurt. You know, this hurts or that hurts. So they listen to that. How they keep from becoming hypochondriac, I don't know. But evidently they do. Some of you may be in the medical field and know exactly what I'm talking about. Another thing about elders needing exhortation and needing encouragement is because they many times have to wear two or three hats. Here's a man trying to serve as a leader of God's people, but he has his own profession, he has his own job to take care of, and more importantly, he has a family to take care of. And so he ends up having all of these demands made on his time. Okay, I'm going to, and it takes a tremendous amount of time to serve as an elder in God's church. I remember one time at Creve Hall, the elders needed some help. I mean, we got down, we had, I think, six elders, and we were running over 1,500 people. And I went before the elders and said, brethren, would you think about the advice that Jethro gave to Moses? I mean, you know, you're going to wear yourself out. So he said, you select men, you know, you have these, and you only handle the more serious demands. Well, they didn't see appropriate to do that, but I knew those men. One of them was an attorney, and I knew those men had a tremendous amount of pressure on their time. And so that's another reason. Somebody needs to come along and say, brethren, look, you're doing the greatest job on earth. So when you feel the pressure, when you are weary mentally and emotionally and perhaps even physically, just remember, God is going to provide some way, somehow, someday. So elders need a tremendous amount of exhortation. They need it because they have their own spiritual lives to be taken care of. A preacher has to be real careful that he doesn't become too oriented to the needs of those to whom he preaches. Now, I don't mind telling you the problem that I ran into after 16 years of preaching for the same congregation. How do you be creative? You know, how are you fresh? How do you keep from playing the same thing over and over? That's why a preacher has to do a whole lot of reading just for his own personal benefit. I'm talking about reading the Bible. Just read it for your own personal benefit. And you have to develop a plan. So my plan has been to read through the Bible every year. And what I'm doing now, I'm recording where I am when I've finished reading a certain part of the scripture. And in fact, I had a layover in Tampa, and so I read through the book of Esther and finished Nehemiah. And that's noted in my Bible, because what I'm planning to do is to give each grandchild one of these Bibles, and then they can know where their granddaddy was on a certain date and when he was reading the scripture, and maybe it'll encourage them to read it through. But I have to read the Bible not to look for sermon material. I have to read the Bible for Tom's benefit, to try to keep me close to God. So, elders need a lot of exhortation. Now, I want to talk about what God needs in elders. And because of the time factor, I'm not going to spend as much time on each of these as probably I would otherwise. When David said, you know, take as long as you want to, they told me that in Memphis back a few weeks ago. Tuesday night I spoke on their lecture program, and I got so enthused about it, I lost the clock, and I went for an hour without even realizing what I'd done. And I'm sure those that were trying to take care of kids said, no, he went 5 hours. Spiritual men. God needs spiritual men to serve in the eldership. Now, the basic reason for that is 1 Peter 2 and 5. The apostle said, you also as living stones are being built up a spiritual house, a holy priesthood, to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God by Jesus Christ. Now, the word spiritual is kind of a buzzword out on the religious scene today. There are any number of people who, if they were answering a questionnaire about their religion, they may answer like this: I'm not religious, but I'm spiritual. In fact, George Barna and his research institute, they try to keep their finger on the pulse of what is happening socially and religiously in America. In 2005, Barna wrote a book entitled Revolution. I ran into that book. I was reading an article in U.S. News and World Report explaining why so many young people are leaving these big mega churches. And he mentioned that book, Revolution. So I charged down to Barnes & Noble and bought that book and read it that night. And on page 13, they claim that at least 20 million Americans have dropped out of what they would call organized religion. Ironically, the percentage of people in surveys who say, you know, I pray to God and I'm spiritual. I've got information printed out on a popular entertainer. I'll not call this entertainer's name. You'd identify this person. They said, I grew up in a Pentecostal church where we could play music and just, you know, have a great time. Said, now I'm just spiritual, but not religious. But the word spiritual is a good Bible word. Obviously, 1 Peter 2, 5, he used it 2 times. What does it mean? According to W.E. Vine's Expository Dictionary of New Testament Words, the word translated spiritual literally means things that have their origin with God and are consistent with His nature or with His purpose. So when we really talk about a spiritual house, and that's Peter's explanation of the church. What is the church? A spiritual house. What do you mean? I mean it's made up of people who are respecting things that have originated with God and therefore are revealed in His book, revealed in the Word of the Lord. And to be a spiritual person then, I have to be oriented to that which is revealed in the Word of God. Now, unfortunately, there may be people who throw the Church of Christ right into the category of organized religion. Now, congregations are organized if they follow the Bible blueprint. You've got elders, deacons, Philippians 1:1. And yet, the emphasis is not on organization. That's simply to get people so they can function better as a body of God's people. But it is a spiritual house. And the word religion, by the way, is a good Bible word. James used it in the last two verses of James chapter 1. There's nothing wrong with the word religious. There's something wrong if it's a religion that has come from the mind of man instead of out of the mind of God. But here are all these people today that say that they are spiritual. And I say this in a kind way. I wonder how many of those people even know what the word means. I think I know what they mean. They mean, well, you know, I think religious thoughts. No, they wouldn't want that word religious. I think spiritual thoughts. I pray to God, and occasionally I'll even read the Bible. And so I feel like, as one person told me, I can get as close to God on the creek bank on Sunday morning fishing as I can in a church. I feel sorry for people like that, don't you? They've never understood worship. They don't know the power of true worship to God. But if we are spiritual people, then we start out with a spiritual mindset. That's straight out of Romans 8. After Paul had said, beginning with verse 1, there is now, therefore, no condemnation to them that are in Christ Jesus, who walk not after the flesh, but after the Spirit. For the law of the Spirit of life in Christ Jesus hath made me free from the law of sin and death. For what the law could not do, in that it was weak through the flesh, God sending his own Son in the likeness of sinful flesh and for sin, condemned sin in the flesh, that the righteousness of the law might be fulfilled in us who walk not after the flesh, but after the Spirit. For they that are after the flesh are carnal, they mind the things of the flesh. But they that are after the Spirit, the things of the Spirit. For to be carnally minded is death, but to be spiritually minded is life and peace. Because the carnal mind is not subject to the law of God. Neither indeed can be. So they that are in the flesh cannot please God. Now, we're all in a fleshly body, but we better not be of the flesh. We better not be carnal in our mindset. We must not be so oriented to this old world that we lose sight of our priorities. Like Jesus said, seek first the kingdom of God and seek God's righteousness. And then everything else will fall beautifully into your priority system. But put God and his righteousness up there with his kingdom. Now, the church is made up of living stones. Back under the old Levitical system, the law of Moses, the first covenant, they had a building. First, it was a temporary type building, a tabernacle. And then that was replaced by a more permanent structure called the temple. Solomon built that one, you remember. He used 153,600 men working 7 years to build that temple. And it must have been a magnificent structure. But unfortunately, when Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians got through with it, it was a pile of ruin. Stayed that way for a little over 70 years. But under the leadership of Ezra and Zerubbabel, who came back from the Babylonian captivity after they had surrendered to the Medes and Persians, under Cyrus, that king permitted them to come back to restore their religion. Came back, laid the foundation for another temple. And at the insistence of Haggai and Zechariah the prophets, they went on and completed that temple. And then old Herod the Great, when he came on the scene, he renovated it, and there it stood when Jesus was here on this earth. And one day Jesus was passing by, and three of his disciples with him, and they showed him that temple. And he shocked them. He said, the day is coming when one stone will not be left on another. And they thought, he's talking about the end of the world. He's got to be talking about his second coming. And those were the questions. What will be the sign of your coming? What will be the end of the world? And you're not talking about that. And so, sure enough, as he predicted, AD 70 came. Titus and the Roman armies came. And they did to the temple exactly what the Babylonians had done. They reduced it to a memory. And all of the centuries since, it's not been rebuilt. That was the center of the Jewish religion. Is God saying anything to humanity? Now, that temple couldn't be rebuilt on the original site right now because there's an imposing Muslim mosque sitting right there. And probably some of you have seen it. maybe have been through it. And I don't have time to get off into why Hal Lindsey and these boys say, well, you know, that Muslim mosque is going to be destroyed by an earthquake or by an... It's got to go because, you know, that temple's got to be rebuilt. I just remind us that with all of the wealth that the Jewish people control on this earth today, they have never been able to rebuild that temple because God's house today is not a material structure. It's made up of living stones, and it is a spiritual house, not a material structure that the Romans or anybody else could tear down. I mean, this living house, the gates of hell, Jesus said, will not prevail against it. And so elders are spiritual men. They're oriented to the things of God, revealed in the Word of God. They think like that. And that's the beginning of a spiritual mind. It's a thought process. It's a mindset. And we think about spiritual sacrifices. Now, in the old Levitical system, animal sacrifices. We're thinking about spiritual sacrifices. The things that God has ordained under a new covenant for His people to do in His honor and to the good of their fellow man. Now, I'm going to rush on then to the second thing. Elders have to be informed men. I want to use an example, something that happened when David was in the process of forming his kingdom. 1 Chronicles 12. He had various representatives of the different tribes, you know, the 12 tribes of Israel, had representatives from the various tribes coming to him. And according to the record in 1 Chronicles 12 and 32, there were 200 men from the tribe of Issachar that came down to Hebron and pledging the devotion and loyalty of that tribe to David's kingdom. And it said about those men that they had understanding of the times that they might know what Israel ought to do. And their brethren were at their command. Understanding of the times. Elders have to be informed men. They have to understand the time. I love history. Love to read history. And I know today history doesn't get high marks with a lot of folks. But I love history. And it's kind of like what you see in the Air Force Museum up at Dayton, Ohio. When I was leaving, I was up in a meeting and had opportunity to go through it and to see those planes that the presidents have used through the years, starting back with Roosevelt. When you get near the end, and right before you start out, there's a plaque quoting the words of a Spanish philosopher, poet by the name of George Santa Anna, that says, "Those that do not know the past are destined to repeat its mistakes." So I like history. But it's one thing to write history. You know, a competent historian can take materials from a given era and he can analyze those and he can frame that for you in terminology that you can read and understand. And so you can kind of know what was going on back then. But to know what's going on when it's happening, now that's different. Like one fellow observed, 5% of people make things happen. 10% of people watch things happen. 85% of people don't know what is happening. Now, I'm not sure that that's reliable, but I'll tell you, elders have to be informed people. They have to know what's going on. They have to know what's happening. And I'm not talking about just knowing what's happening in a congregation. As essential as that is, they have to know what is happening in the culture. What is happening that can impact the thought and the life of the people that comprise the congregation where they are serving God. So that means a lot of study, a lot of research. Now, because I do these workshops, I try to keep myself informed about what's happening. Therefore, I have to do a tremendous amount of reading. I read World Magazine, for example, just to try to keep up with what's going on. I used to read U.S. News and World Report back when you could rely on them to report fact instead of trying to make fact. And I even read an interdenominational magazine called Christianity Today just to try to keep up with what's going on out in the religious world generally. And then if I hear of a book, like I saw an ad recently for a new book that's out, The Death of Leadership, I thought, I got to read that one. And I'm thinking that may be to sell books. It's like this little boy that went to heaven, you know. He is selling books about what he saw in heaven. And somebody asked me about that Sunday, and I said, you know, this is interesting to me. The Apostle Paul was caught up there, and he said it was not lawful for him to tell even what he heard. But I guess as a kid, you know, you're going to tell it anyway. So I'm waiting for the little boy to come back after being in hell and tell what that's like, too. Don't be surprised. I mean, I just glanced at the book offering over at the airport yesterday, and man, there are a lot of books now about heaven. You'd be surprised. And it tells me that anytime we have a type of situation where people need reassurance and hope, somebody will capitalize on that. But that's all I'm going to say on that point right now. But I do try to keep up with what's going on. I can tell you for a fact that in the denominational world, they are in serious trouble. Barna picked up on this in 1997 in a book entitled, If Things Are So Good, Why Do I Feel So Bad? And that people in denominational churches have lost confidence in them. Now, I'll give you one quick example. The largest Protestant denomination in the world is in serious trouble. They claim to have 16 million members. On a given Sunday, they acknowledge about 6 million show up. Now, that's a pretty significant difference right there. In a convention they had in Indianapolis, I guess it's 2 years ago now, this was the topic of discussion. What are we going to do with all of these people that don't even show up? There is a relatively new book that I read, I guess last year, written by the man in that denomination that kind of heads up one division of their printing. And listen to the title of his book, Essential Church. And as I read it and saw him using the scriptures that gospel preachers have been using for years to say the church is important, like Ephesians 5:25, the Lord loved the church and gave himself for it. And I'm amazed that now they are emphasizing the importance of the church. And this man in that book says, we've got too many people that are CEOs. They only show up for Christmas and Easter or other special occasions. Well, they've got a problem. I'm telling you, it's just an indication. And if you throw in that the community church movement, you see exactly what I'm talking about. The religious world out there generally, denominationalism, is in trouble, and their leaders know they are in trouble. And I'm saying this is the day for the Lord's church. This is the day for us to affirm anew. We get together in a group the way God has ordained it. We are autonomous. We don't have a headquarters somewhere on this earth. In heaven's our headquarters. And, you know, when we are to the point spiritually that there are men that can serve as the bishops of the church, that is, the overseers of it, they're the older people, they're the elders, the more mature people, And we have an elder rule. I mean, the community church. Now, I'll admit to you that some of the community churches, they simply have a facade out there with that name, community church. If you look behind, it's the same denomination. But there are others, they've broken with their denomination. And they're out there as an autonomous religious group of people. Where God's people, where His church has been all the time. It's our day. And the devil, as we all know, he is smart. Man, he is smart. I call him Dr. Devil. A lot of times when he throws something at me, I say, Dr. Devil, I'm not taking that one. And he is a sharp cookie. And I think it's interesting that at the very moment when the Lord's church could shine forth so brilliantly in the very way we are structured according to the will of God, there are people that want to turn us into a Johnny-come-lately denomination. Caught up in this emerging church movement. That's one of the big movements. I don't hear as much about that as I did. Well, in 2005, they had a big convention in Nashville, the emerging church folks. Now, if it's emerging, you don't even know where it's going, do you? If these fellows that said, we want the church to change, the question, to what? You want to change to what? Now we know. They want us to say, we're just going to be a denomination. While that's dying, you know, it's kind of like years ago when, and I don't say this critically, I think a lot of brethren want to do anything they could to try to stir up enthusiasm. So after a lot of religious groups had run the bus program into the ground, then we had to get it. Everybody had to have a bus. And there were guys so enthused about it, they'd speak about it, and you nearly got the impression, you'll either get a bus ministry or you're going to be lost. Take your pick, you know. Got to have it. So here came those old worn-out school buses. And here we go. Going to have us a bus ministry. Not proper preparation for it or anything, just got to have a bus ministry. And I've thought so many times, my daddy, who served as an elder in a congregation in Alabama for a long time, my dad had a bus ministry before anybody, I guess, ever thought about it. Our bus was our flatbed 2-ton truck. He put the cattle racks on it, and people out in that part of the country, not all that many people had cars back in those days. I'm talking about back in the Depression era. So he, on Sunday morning, he ran a route, picking up people, giving them a ride to church. Did it for years. And never knew he had a bus ministry. But so I'm not against picking people up and bringing them to worship. But we need to be understanding. These people, a lot of them, they probably have never been in a worship service. And so there's going to have to be a lot of preparation made. But elders just have to understand why Jesus prayed the way he did in the Lord's Prayer, the real Lord's Prayer, John 17. Starting in verse 14, he said, I pray not that thou shouldest take them out of the world, but that thou shouldest keep them from the evil, literally the evil one. They're not of the world, even as I am not of the world. And he said, sanctify them through thy truth. Set them apart through your truth, the power of your truth. Set them apart so they'll be different from the world. Why did he pray that his disciples not be taken out of the world? Did they need the world? No. But brother, the world needed them. The world needed the salt and the light of the people of God. And if the world has ever needed that, now is the time they have an acute need for it. When so many false philosophies have burdened the minds of people and have deceived them, and I'll just mention one, the philosophy of relativism, and I may have occasion to give you the background of that, but relativism basically asserts there are no absolutes. And so you decide what is truth for you. And that's where a lot of folks are operating today, I promise you. And so consequently, to try to get people to accept that there's something that is absolutely right and something that there's absolutely wrong, because there is a God who says this is right and this is wrong, that's very hard to get people generally to accept today. And that's where a lot of folks are coming from. But I'm going to take time to mention at least one other thing that God needs, and I'll just show you the others. God needs sacrificial men. Now, I know we live in an age of convenience, and a lot of it I really, really appreciate. I loaned my cell phone to a gentleman last night. We were out. I was waiting for David to pick me up, and he was needing to get in touch with somebody, and he saw I had a cell phone, and he wanted to know if he could borrow my cell. He said it's a local call, and I have Southeastern anyways. Yeah, sure. So I'm thinking, what did we ever do without cell phones? You know, how did we live without them? I vividly recall as a child, the first phone we had was in a wooden box, and you had 8 people on a party line, and each person had their own little signal. Our signal, if I remember, 2 longs and 1 short. Rings, I'm talking about. if that thing rang out there, two longs, one short, that's our number. Okay, you pick it up, and by the time seven other people pick up to eavesdrop, you've got to be practically shouting to make the person hear you on the other end of that line. And then we left that and went to dial phone. Boy, we were moving up. And then those things became obsolete and went punching it. That's a lot easier than, you know, sometimes when your fingers sore or something. Punch that thing. And man, we are moving up in the world. And then we went to car phones. And I noticed when I'd be on my way to the office going through Brentwood that the guys that were with it, they had that phone on their shoulder talking as they drove through. So I asked one of our deacons if he could get me an old phone. And he said, yeah, sure. I said, get me one. I'd go through Brentwood every morning with my phone on my shoulder, connected to nothing. But I was having fun. I thought, boy, that guy, he's uptown. He's got one of those car phones, no doubt about it, talking to myself. I like to talk to intelligent people. But cell phones and computers. When I was in the first grade, if I hadn't had a computer, I'd never made it. I'm just checking to see if you're awake. Man, I was in the first grade about 1936. Never heard of such a thing. The first computer I ever read about was, I think, at the University of Michigan, and it took a whole room to house that thing. And now, you got one in your pocket? Maybe. At least a modified computer. So we have moved up in the world and got a lot of conveniences. I used to speak a lot to youth gatherings. I don't get many invitations for those anymore. I'm still trying to figure out why. They're coming now from older folks. In fact, I think next Saturday I'm supposed to speak to a senior group somewhere. And I just remind them, you know, I hear people say, well, back in the good old days. Well, I lived in the good old days. No electricity. Our bathroom was about probably 25 yards from the house. I heard one man say he remembered the time their bathroom burned, didn't even smoke the house. And I was reading it. I was reading his signal very clearly. Well, you know, boyhood days, cold winter, fireplace for heat. Get out of bed on a linoleum rug. Oh, man, like stepping out on ice. Now, I love it. You know, I can set a little dial. Keeps me warm. Push one little switch, set the dial. Cools me down in the sun. Conveniences. My first automobile, I didn't have air conditioning. I was uptown, didn't know it. I had four on the floor with a straight shift. It was a 31 Model A. And mechanical brakes. I remember in an emergency one time in Athens, the light turned on me. I had to use reverse to stop it. Bought a transmission for $20 for it after I stopped it that way. Man, you know, if I know my ABCs, I can drive a vehicle now. D for drive, you know, pull it down to D and be on your merry way. Conveniences, they are everywhere. And people tell me, older people, oh, I tell you what, food doesn't take the way it did when Mama used to cook it on that old wood stove. And I say, uh-huh. And you've forgotten, haven't you, how long it took Mama to cook it on that old wood stove? By the time she got it cooked, you were hungry enough to eat bark off of trees. So, I say, do you know when the good old days are? You are right smack dab in the middle of them. Okay, who wants to sacrifice? In an age of luxury and comfort and convenience, who wants to sacrifice? Who wants to sacrifice time? I'm busy. You know, I got a lot of things to do. Who wants to sacrifice the effort that has to be put forth? I'd leave my office on Sunday night, and it seemed like every Sunday night, the wives of our elders were sitting there on a pew because their husbands had been called into a meeting. You elders, you know what I'm talking about. I mean, a lot of unexpected meeting. They could have been home with their family. And here, they're in a meeting about the Lord's work, and their wives are sitting out there on that pew. I finally insisted to the point, they patted that pew. I said, look, if those good women are willing to sit out there Sunday night after Sunday night on that old pew, at least pat it for them. And if you go up to that Creve Hall building today, I guarantee you, you look at that pew, it has a nice pad on it where it should have been in the first place. See, a man sacrifices a lot of family time. And a man sacrifices sometimes a lot of time he could be spending with his business. So he sacrifices time for his business, sacrifices time for his family, and sacrifices time sometimes even for his own physical needs. I could be at the health club, you know, and I'm spending all this time here with these people because of their spiritual problems. A sacrificial spirit, a man just has to have it to serve God. And I recall a time when our elders were trying to get three other men to help them in the eldership, and all three turned it down because they said, our business is so demanding, we just don't have the time to do it. And I'm not being critical of those men. They just realized, boy, it takes time to serve as an elder in God's church. And how many times is that never really appreciated? I think that's another reason elders need exhortation. Too often they serve in a capacity where there's too much criticism and not enough commendation. And they just need somebody to come along and say, brethren, you're doing the greatest work on earth. I hope you won't give up. Hold on. One of these days, God's going to reward you for that, as sure as he says it in his word there in 1 Peter chapter 5. When the chief shepherd shall appear, you'll receive a crown of life that fades not away. Now, I want to say this to those who are wives of elders, or if you become an elder, I want to say it to your wife. Jesus said in a marriage, two become one, right? So if the elder is going to be the recipient of a great reward, since his wife is one with him, she is in for the reward also. The two are one. And you wives, please don't forget that. I said that at polishing the pulpit a year or two ago, and there were some elders' wives that told me how much they appreciated somebody respecting also their involvement in the Lord's work with their husband. They sacrifice a lot of time so their husband can do the Lord's work. Just have to have that sacrificial spirit. Well, I was going to go on with this one. They have to be courageous men. I was going to read to you from the first chapter of Joshua, verses 6 through 9, where three times God told Joshua, be courageous. And finally said, be strong and of good courage. I'm with you. And I'll tell you, elders just have to have a lot of courage today. They have to make decisions that are not going to be popular, and they know they're not going to be popular. And they have to be courageous enough to make them anyway. It'd be a lot easier a lot of times just to go with the flow than to stand for what is true and for what is right. Need to be men of courage. And then, men who follow God's model. Elderships have a model that they follow. And it could be an inherited model. Okay, here's an eldership, and here are men that become old and they die. Okay, then other men are asked to come in and start serving with the elders. So what model do you suppose these that come in are going to follow? The one that's already being followed. What are the possibilities? The business model. That's where elders meet and make decisions, just like a business, you know. The educational model, where elders use the way an educational system is structured. You have a superintendent, you have principals, you have assistant principals, and decisions are made. So that could be a model. The military model. I imagine there are those here that have been in the military. And, you know, you got a chain of command in the military. And incidentally, there have been a lot of young men who thought they were rebels that the Army or Navy or Marines convinced them that they could be just kind of humble type guys. I mean, it's happened to many a time. And I've known a few situations where people wanted a son to go into the military, so maybe they could teach him respect for authority. And they have a way of doing that. But it's a chain of command. Now, I know of a situation where a retired military man came into a congregation, good Christian man, and after a while, he was asked to serve as an elder. And so he evidently transferred the military model over to the eldership. And the first thing he did, he lined up the preacher hour by hour for his activities. And preachers, David and I were talking about this yesterday. We can't operate like that. You know, unfortunately, I cannot keep a person from calling me at midnight with some kind of serious problem. I cannot say I punch a clock. I punch in at 8, I punch out at 4. But I cannot anticipate the 5 o'clock call that says, please get to the hospital, that this person just had a serious accident. Or I cannot clock out and say, well, I'm not going to try to teach anybody. They'll have to come. I'm not going to go to anybody's home and try. Man, I've got other things. No, I can't punch it out. And so I go to their home. I study with them. I try to bring them back if they're unfaithful to the Lord. And my way of working, the places I have worked on a regular basis, like the one now. First thing I did, first Sunday, I want the names and addresses of all of those that are not attending faithfully. And I've been to every one of them. I've been more than once to a lot of them. And up to this point, I'm going to have to confess to you, only one person has come back. Only one. But I figure that one's worth more than the world and everything that's in it. Wouldn't you agree with that? I went to one lady, she was a school teacher, unfaithful. I went to try to get her to be faithful to the Lord, be restored. I told one of our elders, I said, I'm pretty sure when I drive up, she says, there's that old Tom Holland back here trying to get me to come back to church. And I said, I'm guilty. But you're not supposed to die at 53, are you, if you're a school teacher? But she did. But I'll tell you one thing. She will not look at me in the day of judgment and say, why didn't you try to get me to be restored? I'll say, you remember all those times I everything but begged you to come back? See, I can't clock out and say, I'm not going to go to these folks. Try to, like the Sunday afternoons that I go trying to get people to obey the gospel or come back to the Lord. I can't clock out and say, well, you know, I preached this morning. My work is over. You know, there used to be an old statement. This is an agricultural statement. A man works from sun to sun. A woman's work is never done. Well, now, as a preacher, a preacher's work is never done. And, you know, I've gotten those 1 o'clock phone calls in the morning. And, you know, that's the way it is. But this military man, he had this preacher so structured that the preacher couldn't do his work. So guess what happened? He found another place to work where people understood preachers can't work by clocks. It's not the nature of their work. Well, we need men who follow God's model. What is God's model? Go back to 1 Peter 5 and verse 2. Shepherd the church. That's God's model. The shepherd and the sheep. For about 13 years, there was a program in Murfreesboro, Tennessee on a Saturday. And it was understood by those of us who were participating, we want to try to encourage elders to become shepherds. Not to think it's done in a business meeting. It's done among the people, identifying with the people. Now, there's a business aspect to the Lord's work. You know, Acts 6, the apostle said, choose out men whom we may appoint over this business. There was a business. And yet, where is the emphasis? On business or on what's done? It's on the service, God's model. And I just urge elders, go to the 23rd Psalm. If you want to know how to function as a shepherd of God's people, go to the 23rd Psalm. The other Sunday, I preached on one aspect of the 23rd Psalm. The shepherd restores my soul. He restoreth my soul. I will promise you, where you serve as an elder, there are a lot of folks that need a restoration of their souls. They're discouraged. They've had things that have broken their hearts. And they just need to know there are people who really care about me. It's sincere. It's as genuine as anything could possibly be. They have an interest in me. They have a love for my soul. And they do everything to strengthen me and to build me up. And I mentioned to the folks, I said, now I'm going to tell you, the first time I ever tried to make a talk, it was 1943. I was baptized August the 7th, 1943. The following December, I was told by the preacher, we want you to make a talk Wednesday night. I didn't come from a preaching family, so I didn't know how to get up a talk. So I thought, well, I'll talk about the 23rd Psalm. I can talk about that. Would you believe I gave a homiletical, hermeneutical, exegetical masterpiece on the 23rd Psalm in 3 minutes flat? I had that thing covered in 3 minutes, and the brethren have wished ever since I could do it again. And it took me 30 minutes just to deal with that idea. He restores my soul. But shepherds can look right there and learn how to be good shepherds of God's people. Just be careful when you read Ezekiel chapter 34. I was going to go into that chapter today, but because of the time factor, I will not. But that's a warning to shepherds who don't really serve the sheep as God would have them to be served. Well, I'm not saying that I have exhausted this thing today about elders. God let me write a book a few years ago entitled Encouraging Elders. And I was motivated to write that book because I had heard too much criticism of elders and too little commendation. And I believe it ought to be swapped. I believe elders ought to get a lot of commendation and very little criticism. Because a lot of folks that criticize don't know what's taking place. They don't know the background. They don't know the inner working of the system. I was preaching at a place and was having Sunday dinner in the home of one of the elders, and while his wife is finishing the preparation for the dinner, he said, I got a letter from one of our members this week. I said, oh? Said, I want you to read it. So I put on my defensive armor. I said, okay. In essence, I said, bring her on. I know she's reading the pedigree of the elders. Well, this man, Brother Vallis Stultz, Brother Vallis is a great Christian man. He's on the county commission in Gibson County, and I guess they still do it. If he's on for years, I know, they always started their meetings with Brother Vallis leading the county commissioners in prayer. That gives you an idea of the respect that they had for him. But anyway, he brought this letter in, and as he handed it to me, I noticed, now I'm an emotional type, he's not. But I noticed his chin was quivering when he handed it to me. He said, I really appreciate this letter. So I started reading it. Dear brother, I want you and the other elders to know that for one, I really appreciate the time that you're giving to the Lord's work. Think you're doing a great job, great service for the Lord. I mean, just the kind of letters elders need to get. And he appreciated it. And I have never forgotten that lady for writing that letter. For a long time, I guess now she's with the Lord. For a long time, she always came to the Diana singing. Every time I saw her, the first thing that popped, bless your heart, you wrote the good letter to the elders. So elders need some folks to recognize the service they're giving to God. And I'm trying to do that. And I'm trying to teach a congregation to do that. And I'll go and tell a congregation, for example, based on Hebrews 13, 17, obey them that have the rule over you and submit yourselves, for they watch for your souls, that they may do it with joy and not with grief. And I'll say to a congregation, now, if I ask your elders, are you serving the Lord here with joy? And you can say, you'd better know it. They have commended you as a congregation. They really have. The place to serve the Lord as an elder ought to be one where I am thrilled that God lets me serve in this capacity. It's the great honor of my life to serve God in this capacity. So tell me, if you're serving with joy, and you've told me more than you ever know about the congregation where you're serving as a shepherd. Well, there's a lot to be said there, but I'll quit on this one, and we'll take a break, David, and then we'll talk about deacons. Thank you so much for being here. I know this is Saturday. You could be home watching that educational TV where they advertise all those cereals you need to get, and you could get those little toys they used to give. God bless you for being here.